potentially for warfare, could be used for warfare on insects and disease within crops. And we learnt how to, well, we probably did that already, but press the atmosphere into little tablets, which save plants doing it. It's urea. So that's basically, you take the atmosphere, a huge amount of pressure and temperature, and you compress it, and you get an ammonium urea tablet. Okay, that's why this fertilizer is actually a problem for greenhouse gas, because that's what it is. It came from the atmosphere, it's come back. Okay, just a lot of fossil fuel was used in the process. Details, so I'm not going to go through all those details there, it's just a few little examples. But also, farmers were returning, they needed to do something. So soldier settlements, these occurred in Tasmania as well as New Zealand. A lot of soldiers actually were promised land in a lot of these wars. You know, you'll get a piece of the land you're trying to fight for and defend. That was an important idea as well. So it's not just technology, it's also politics and ideas about what the future. Okay, so that's another event. Then jump forward another 20 years or so, and we had to share that, or we felt the need to share that great knowledge, because this is largely a Western thing so far. Europe, New Zealand, Australia, USA. So this is Norman Borlaug, and first of all, we just went down the road to Mexico to extend some of these ideas that were coming out of this great agricultural revolution. And this part of it, post the industrial agricultural revolution, the Green Revolution, was funded by some wealthy industrialists like Rockefeller and the Ford Foundation, and Borlaug was the key scientist in the centre of it, particularly focusing on breeding, you know, high-yielding grains, dwarf grains, so they could have to dwarf the stems so they could actually hold the amount of grain to feed the world. And India was a big beneficiary of this in Southeast Asia as well. So high-yielding rice was the big one, but also wheat, corn, and these ideas were extended, there into Asia. Not so much Africa, actually, and South America. In fact, there's a big move on at the moment, Green Revolution for Africa. But they needed higher input, so it did have to change the farming systems. Some needing irrigation, Southeast Asia is quite heavily irrigated anyway, but also fertilisers, and some of these varieties were more susceptible to pests or drought. As I discovered in Africa myself, and other things too, like flavour. I was for a time in the University of Namibia teaching, and there it's millet that they eat, millet. And it's very, very variable climate, very, very like Australia actually, in terms of high variability of rainfall. And they had nutted out over the years to grow millet grain that was very drought tolerant and very tasty, but really low yielding. So in the next phase, beyond Borlaug, I was working with Japanese researchers. They're out in Africa trying to bring in new types of high yielding millet. But they weren't having much success because it didn't taste right. So even something like taste can affect whether you do something. It's cultural as well.
Did you get a higher yield?
So? Yeah, a huge yield. Massive higher yield, yeah. But maybe at a cost of the same flavour profile that they were used to, and maybe not as tolerant to drought. I can't remember the details, but it mightn't have been as tolerant to droughts. So high yielding in a good or moderate year, but just zero in a drought year. Whereas the varieties they had, they knew they were okay. Yeah. Good question. And we'll stop for a few questions after this slide. So this is my third graph for this afternoon, for your ponderances. I've only copied two of them, but